From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, what can we learn from four states that have pulled ahead of Michigan in student achievement and performance?
All of them put a lot of emphasis on giving training to their teachers once they get into the classroom, as opposed to handing them the keys and saying, good luck for the next 40 years.
Auto sales in China are slowing down. Who's winning and who's losing?
The Chinese consumers are quite sophisticated. They're very aware of what's going on in the world. And guess what? They want the best stuff that's out there.
How our smartphones have turned us into little lab rats seeking a Rice Krispie reward for running a maze.
There are intermittent positive reinforcements that we come to expect them enough that we're always wanting to check.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, what can Michigan schools learn from four states that have pulled way ahead in student achievement and performance?
Some spend more, some spend less. It's not so much how much they spend, it's how they spend it.
Later this hour, we try to figure out what works and what doesn't across the country. Then a look at smartphones versus dumb phones. That story comes up in 15 minutes. But first, Michigan drivers who feared they had seen the last of gas prices under $3 a gallon are happily discovering they were wrong. GasBuddy.com reports average pump price in Michigan is $3.08 a gallon, and there are plenty of stations selling for way less. In West Michigan, Greenville is boasting some of the cheapest gas in the nation, with several stations serving it up at $2.85 a gallon. Patrick DeHaan is a senior petroleum analyst at GasBuddy.com. Are you surprised by this free fall in gas prices?
You know, it's been quite a bit more significant than what we've seen in recent years. There's certainly factors that enhance that decrease that I'm sure we'll be mentioning. But it's a bigger decrease, a faster decrease, and it's going to bring prices lower than what we saw last year.
And where does Michigan, with our $3.08 a gallon, how does that compare with the national average or other parts of the country?
Well, you know, right now, Michigan stands about 10 cents under the national average. A national average is holding about $3.18 a gallon. Michigan's plunge has been quite a bit quicker, falling 13 cents a gallon in the last week. Meanwhile, the national average fell about 9 cents a gallon. So, by and large, it's been pretty good for Michigan motorists. As you mentioned yesterday, stations in Greenville were selling at $2.55 a gallon, likely losing about 35 cents a gallon. Why would they sell so far under cost, you ask? Well,
yeah,
that's what can happen with price wars. And believe it or not, that's what we're talking about now that could happen with OPEC.
Mm-hmm. Because there is a lot going on in OPEC that is affecting what we pay as we drive up to our local gas station. How is this free fall playing among OPEC members?
Well, you know, Saudi Arabia really started it about 2 weeks ago, kind of out of the blue, surprised the market by saying it's going to cut crude oil prices for customers in October. When you have the world's largest oil producer voluntarily cutting prices, it sent the market into a tizzy. And boy, did oil prices drop on that concern that perhaps, hey, why is OPEC doing this? Things are suddenly getting cheaper. And then last week, Iran and Iraq joining the chorus. And there is talk about perhaps this could tip off an OPEC price war. Oil prices down to about 84 when last week they were at 89. So the decrease continues, and it's good news at the pump with the decrease in oil.
And why are the Saudis saying, you know what, we're going to cut prices? What's going on?
You know, there hasn't been many folks that know what's going on with the Saudis. They haven't really said why they're cutting prices, although some believe it might be to help the U.S. In its disagreements and sanctions against Russia. Russia's number one GDP contributor is energy, so maybe it's to upset the Russians. Maybe it's to upset ISIS. We're not really sure why the Saudis would cut oil prices.
How about the surge in U.S. oil production? Is that impacting, and how much has that gone up to affect this?
Yeah, that's another big contributing factor. Is silently in the background over the last 10 years, U.S. production has increased to almost 9 million barrels a day now. 5-10 years ago, we were struggling to hit 6 million barrels. So we're talking about a big increase in output domestically, and the U.S. now stands very near to Saudi Arabia's oil output, and that's a big deal. That's another contributing factor and certainly helping put downward pressure on pump prices as well.
So we're basically seeing some good old-fashioned Adam Smith economics at work here. But as you pointed out, these stations, for example, selling for $2.55 are losing money. I suspect they're losing money selling at $2.97 a gallon. I saw that Sunday evening in Sterling Heights. So can this last?
It may not last. The relatively lower prices will last. Maybe not at the bargain basement prices that we're seeing today. So motorists shouldn't necessarily believe that the 275s, the 280s will stick around. We may see some price adjustments like Michigan tends to see every 2 weeks or so. But by and large, prices should remain relatively low through at least Christmas.
We'll watch and see. In the meantime, I guess we'll be grateful for those blessings at the pump when we get them.
That's right.
Patrick DeHaan, Senior Petroleum Analyst with GasBuddy.com. Thanks so much, Patrick.
Always a pleasure.
Automakers look to China to rev up their global sales. And we've learned that growth in China's car sales slowed again in September. We wondered why that's happening and what it means for the U.S. carmakers who want to get their vehicles onto Chinese streets and highways. Auto analyst John McElroy is here. He's host of the AutoLine Daily Webcast. John, what can you tell us about the Chinese car sales for September?
Well, the rate of growth is slowing down. Now, that doesn't mean that car sales are going down. They're just not increasing as fast as they have before. And, of course, this is a danger for not just the automakers operating in the Chinese market there. It's a danger signal for the Chinese economy as well, because this is a direct indicator of economic health in the Chinese economy.
What's going on in the Chinese economy to cause this growth to slow?
Well, you know, there's a whole host of reasons, and I don't even pretend to be an economist on this. But you'll notice in especially the business media these days, there's a lot of concern that China has not been growing as fast as in the past. And the country itself has established a target of growing 7.5% every year. That is, growing its gross domestic product, its GDP, 7.5%. If they do that, that growth creates enough jobs for everybody. If they do not hit that growth, there could be a lot of unemployment, and that might lead to social unrest. That's why it's considered a danger signal that the rate of growth is slowing down.
Yeah, and again, we're saying they're growing, but just not as fast. I noticed September passenger vehicle sales were up 6.4%, but in May it was 13.9%.
That's correct.
So,
and while any market would be happy with that kind of growth, that 6.5% especially is a measure of concern.
How are foreign brands doing against Chinese brands? Give us a sense of who's winning the race for market share.
Well, you know, the Chinese consumers are quite sophisticated. They're very aware of what's going on in the world. And guess what? They want the best stuff that's out there. And they see that that is international brands, i.e. largely from Europe, the United States, and Japan. Those are the brands that they want. And as a result, foreign car makers have something like 65% or so of the Chinese market. They've done much better than the Chinese local brands have done. And in fact, that's alarmed the Chinese government enough that it is starting to change the rules of the game to benefit the Chinese car companies. We've seen subsidies for buying what the Chinese call new energy cars, that is, cars that get better fuel economy. Almost all of those subsidies, or I should say that the vast majority of those subsidies, go to the Chinese brands only. Up to now, we've seen Chinese government agencies and government corporations and even members of the military buying Audis as their company or organization car. Just this year, the Chinese government has come out with regulations saying that no Chinese government or any kind of government agency can buy those foreign branded cars. Even though they're made in China, they are no longer allowed to buy them. They can only buy Chinese brand cars. And then there's been an investigation into the alleged anti-monopoly practices of foreign car brands in terms of the prices they have on their repair parts. And you put it all together, and there's a growing concern amongst the foreign automakers that the Chinese government is starting to throw roadblocks in their path.
So if I'm in charge of trying to sell General Motors or Ford vehicles in China, and I'm watching this because it's taken a while to ramp up to, you know, to get that toehold in the Chinese market, what do I do to try to stay ahead of that?
Well, you know, so far this has not impacted General Motors whatsoever. In fact, GM just had a gangbusters month in September in terms of sales there. Ford slowed down somewhat, but Ford has been on an astonishing tear in the Chinese market, just rocketing up the sales chart. And so you don't want to read too much into just one month's sales numbers. You really want to look back and see how's it been going for the year. And for the American brands, it's been pretty good. Now, I think the reason they're doing so well is the Japanese brands have not been doing well in China of late. And as I'm sure you're aware and your listeners are aware, there's simmering tensions between China and Japan, and that definitely seems to be hurting sales of Japanese-branded cars in China.
Which then presents opportunities for American brands.
It does, but, you know, it's so easy for the shoe to be on the other foot. You know, there could even be some sort of conflagration in the South China Sea involving the United States, and, you know, it could be the Americans who are suffering from this at some point in the future. So you don't really want to say that here's an advantage to take because the Japanese are suffering. It could just as easily turn and hit the Americans or, who knows, even the Europeans as well.
Fascinating. It sounds like the best tool if you're in marketing and trying to sell to China would be a really good crystal ball.
Well, you know, the thing is, just concentrate on the basics. Come out with good cars that really meet the needs of the customer and treat them terrifically. Hug your customers at the dealership level. You know, as long as people really aspire to own your car, to really aspire to be part of your brand, pretty much the rest will take care of itself.
Auto analyst John McElroy hosts the AutoLine Daily webcast. Thank you so much, John.
Cindy, thanks so much.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. They're defying the smartphone tidal wave, flip phones firmly gripped in their hands. They are the people who do not feel the need to stay on email, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter 24/7. Thank you very much. Dave Meyer is with us now. He's a professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Michigan, where he directs the Brain Cognition and Action Laboratory. Welcome, Dave.
Pleased to be with you, Cindy.
There was a recent photo of glamorous, trend-setting Vogue editor Adam Winter using an old-school flip phone, and that got us all talking here and wondering, is there a sturdy contingent of smartphone non-believers out there?
Well, I'm not sure to what extent there is already such a contingent, but it looks to me like recently, because of what's happening in the news media, there's going to be one if there isn't already. And I assume the news media wouldn't be talking about this in the first place if they hadn't already noticed some upsurge in such interest. Whether or not it gets to be a major move back to the past, I suppose, remains to be seen. Probably we're going to wind up with phone wars involving those who use the flip phones and those who use the smart ones. But we'll just have to wait and see on that.
Well, it does provoke conversations like the one we had with our team here, where you kind of look at those flip phone users who can legitimately disconnect beyond texting and phone calls. It makes you wonder, what about those of us who treat the smartphone as an appendage? Where we go, it goes.
This is where it all gets fraught and maybe provides at least part of the reason for why those who are using flip phones don't want to switch over to the smartphones, because as you just pointed out, once you get a smartphone, and I can testify to this personally, because up until about a year and a half ago, I was a flip phone user. I was relatively late coming to the smartphone game. And I have discovered since switching over to smartphone both what the pros of it are and what the cons of it are. And I can attest to the fact that there are cons as well as pros.
Mm-hmm. And I want to hear about those. So what price are we paying for waking up at 6 a.m. and checking emails? Or I've got one of many family photos of my husband a couple of years ago in Ireland checking emails on his smartphone. What price do we pay for that?
Well, I think we pay a price in a number of ways. First of all, it has a risk, and while this hasn't been studied in what I would consider to be a completely scientific way, there's a risk of becoming addicted to your smartphone. And I was telling somebody else just the other day, carrying around one of these smartphones sort of puts you at risk of being like a pigeon in a Skinner box. And Skinner boxes are these little houses into which people like B.F. Skinner put pigeons in order to understand how pigeons learn and what happens when they get rewarded in certain kinds of ways. Similar sorts of devices have been used subsequently to study rats, mice, and other little organisms whose brains were able to open up and examine what's happening in there. And we know there's a reward system now in the brain that becomes activated when an organism, including a human being, interacts with an environment where there are intermittent positive reinforcements that are not always predictable, but we come to expect them enough that we're always wanting to check to make sure whether or not the present one is available. And in fact, we have people at the University of Michigan right now who are studying the details of those parts of the brain that are involved with these reward mechanisms and the phone, because of how it works, where you can't always predict exactly when you're going to be getting messages or other kinds of responses to previous input that you've provided to the system. You're still wanting to know because you're likely, if somebody does provide you with feedback, to feel good about it. That's socially reinforcing.
So when I put a status update on Facebook, it is my reward when I see the little message thing that says there's messages and I take a look and there's comments or likes. That's my reward.
Absolutely. And I discovered I am a potential victim of this too. Part of the reason I got my smartphone is because I actually study these sorts of things, and I felt like if I was going to be able to comment on them and understand what the phenomena were, then I needed to have that kind of device, even if I was putting myself at risk by doing so. So that's one of the cons. There are other ones too.
I will have to tell you, just thinking of our recent family vacation in Europe, my husband, myself, and my daughter, the first thing after we checked into our hotel or guest house was the question, what's the Wi-Fi password? And amongst the three of us, we had three iPhones and two iPads, so we're right on it. And I thought of that, and then your intriguing quote that I saw in a story in sfgate.com. Here's your quote: your smartphone has turned you into a dumb organism. Why?
Well, you got to be careful in answering that question, because I don't want to come across too strong as being anti-smartphone.
No, as you said, there's many rewards to it, and there's many good things about it.
Right. The issue then becomes whether or not you yourself are being smart in how you use your smartphone. Smartphone is like any other sophisticated tool. There are ways in which it can be exploited that will improve the quality of your life, but if you're not careful with how it's used, it can have these downsides as well. So in particular, if you become addicted to your phone and you're constantly checking it in a way that's suboptimal, in effect what you're doing is imposing on yourself a whole bunch of other tasks which are interfering with, interrupting, distracting, breaking your concentration from focusing on other, perhaps even more important tasks. So, for example, you have to write text for the interviews that you do. Professors have to write journal articles. Students have to study. And in order to do those tasks well, you need to devote fairly lengthy periods of time to them where you warm up, you then concentrate, you get a bunch of the task done, and you don't stop until you're at a very convenient break point. And if instead, while you're attempting to do those tasks, you're constantly breaking off, interrupting yourself, and going to do one of these other relatively trivial tasks, Facebook, Twitter, or whatever, each time you do that, you're reducing your efficiency very enormously, such that the overall cost of this could be 100%, maybe even 200% or more in efficiency lost.
So for folks who are listening to your words of wisdom and realize maybe I do need to take a technology break, what advice do you give those folks who are they're not going to give up the smartphone, but how do you use your smartphone and as opposed to it using you?
That's a really, really good question whose answers are still being worked out. But I'd say the first point is simply realize there is a problem. Some people have yet to understand that there are costs to these this whole business. There are macho multitaskers. Maybe even your husband's one of those who thinks somehow they can get away with having the smartphone around and dealing with it all the time in the midst of going about the rest of their business. The fact of the matter is, though, there's nobody immune to these sorts of inefficiencies and deficiencies. The human mind and brain are such that the costs in those respects are inescapable. Secondly, I think you need to formulate for yourself a set of specific strategies, sort of like what you would have if you want to go on a serious diet or on a serious exercise program, where you write down your particular plan for how you're going to deal with this. Make sure it's reasonably intelligent in light of what available scientific knowledge would be. For example, setting aside blocks of times where you need to get tasks done, and turning your phone off, putting it away, preferably in some other room where it's not there staring you in the face, attracting you to deal with it. We know there's this phenomena actually studied by a faculty member at the University of Michigan called incentive salience. What this means is simply that various kinds of objects to which you have become addicted, original example being various kinds of street drugs, such that when you're anywhere around the kinds of paraphernalia that are needed for using and consuming those drugs, like needles, syringes, not to mention the product itself, your attention is immediately drawn to that and away from whatever you're doing. And this happens automatically. It's very hard to control. So step number one in breaking those sorts of habits, as well as your chronic use of the smartphone, is to put it out of view, preferably not easy to get at. So if you're working in your home office, go put your smartphone down in the kitchen in some kind of drawer or whatever, such that it's really going to be a fair amount of work to go get it. Same when you go to bed at night. Don't have it right by your nightstand. Definitely don't put it under your pillow, even though that's what a lot of people would try, because then they wake up in the middle of the night and just look at it before they go back to sleep. And
guilty, Your Honor.
There are additional kinds of such strategies. Make sure that you have enough other highly attractive activities in your life of a social nature that are real as opposed to virtual, where you don't want to be using the phone as engaging in real life social interaction. And under those conditions where you are dealing with another person, make sure you do have your phone turned off and put in your pocket, as opposed to pulling it out while you're at the dinner table or wherever to check your email messages, because that, of course, is going to disrupt the benefits from the real life social interaction.
It is truly a weaning process. Professor Dave Myers with the Department of Psychology at the University of Michigan, where he directs the Brain Cognition and Action Laboratory. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Cindy.
Michigan's fall colors are in full glory right now. And more people are discovering a new way to view all of that autumn glory by being right up there at the top of the trees on a zip line. Detroit Free Press travel writer Ellen Krieger looked into this booming business of zip lines and adventure parks in Michigan. And Ellen, I had no idea there were so many places like this around the state.
A lot of people don't know, and I didn't even realize how many of them there were until I started investigating this. These zip lines and adventure parks have been around in Michigan for at least a decade, but most of them were in private camps or team-building exercise, retreats, that type of thing. But there's a lot more now that the public can use.
And I guess there's a sense that maybe, like, I know I went on a zip line at Spring Hill, at Camp Spring Hill with my daughter when she was small. We did a mother-daughter weekend. So that was, you're right, a private camp. It was a blast. So I guess people are coming out going, I want to do more of this.
Right. And, you know, a lot of these have more than just zip lines. They're called adventure parks. So they have these challenges, like you're wearing a safety harness, but you're climbing trees to these different platforms or going over these swinging bridges. It's almost like an obstacle course type of thing. So it employs zip lines as part of that, but it's also just a little, it's more fun, really. And I think that's what people want. They're bored with just walking through the woods and they want to have some fun.
And who's able to do this?
All right, most of the zip line tours that I looked at, you have to be at least 5 years old, but there's a weight restriction on almost all of them. I think there's 60 or 70 pounds, so most five-year-olds are not going to be able to do that, but maybe they could do a very easy portion of the course. Then there's also an upper weight limit, pretty much around 250, 275, something like that, because of these are safety issues when you get to certain weights. And one of the one of the good tips that one of the guys gave me is don't lie about your weight or your child's weight, because it's a safety issue.
Or medical conditions.
That's right.
So they mean it when they put those restrictions up there. There's a good reason. Now, you describe in your story from Sunday's Free Press a number of really fascinating and exciting sounding adventure parks and zip lines. Give me an example of the coolest fall adventure, a zip line adventure that you found.
All right. Well, a lot of them have Halloween related adventures, and some of them are at night. Some are just glowing. The whole course is glowing. So that's a lot of fun, and you can find out more from that park. But there are a couple of them. The Glacier Valley Eco Zip Tour, that's at the Howell Nature Center just out in Howell, and that just opened in August. It will be open till the end of November. And they have a whole course that you can go on. So if you call the Howell Nature Center, you can find out about that one. The other one around here is the Adventure Park at West Bloomfield, and that just opened this spring, and it runs also through the end of November. That's the one that's more an adventure park. It has 100 platforms, cables, zip lines, that sort of thing. It also has a haunted forest on the weekends this month. So look up the West Bloomfield Adventure Park, and you can find out more about that one. There are other ones around the state, Mount Holiday up in Harrison, Boyne Falls and Boyne Highlands have had them for quite a while, and another big one up north is the Wildwood Rush, and that's in Boyne City. And I think Mount Holiday, the new one that just opened at Mount Holiday in Traverse City, that one is planning to be open all winter. Most of them shut down when the weather gets too snowy or and they'll reopen in the spring.
All right, here's the big question. Did you do a zip line?
I did. I've done them before. I did one in Costa Rica. I haven't done this, although I've seen the one at Boyne, and it looks fun.
Okay. It looks fun. Maybe you and I will go up together and we'll dare ourselves.
Oh, yeah. Good idea.
Ellen, thanks for talking with us.
Sure. Okay. Thank you, Cindy.
Ellen Krieger is the travel writer for the Detroit Free Press. Her story from last Sunday's Free Press contains a list of 7 zip tours all through Michigan and leads to even more zip tours. You can find it at freep.com.
The state of Michigan.
Ensuring quality products today.
48222 is the zip code for the J.W. Westcott. It's the official U.S. Postal Service mailboat that serves Great Lakes vessels. Bill Redding is a boat captain and dispatcher with the J.W. Westcott Company. Good to have you with us, Bill.
It's my pleasure indeed.
There is so much history to talk about before the J.W. Westcott became the first floating zip code in the world. Tell us about John Ward Westcott.
John Ward Westcott had this dream and passion, you might say, going back into the late 1800s. Eventually he put together a business back in 1874 at the J.W. Westcott mailboat. And he realized that there needed to be, with as many sailors that there were in the Great Lakes, find a way to get them their mail.
And there it is, and he came up with the mail and the pail.
That is it. That was our slogan back then and still exists today. We were known to deliver and receive well over 1 million pieces of mail during a given season.
What's a typical day like on the boat?
Maybe just having 3 or 4 boats go by on an 8-hour watch where you're just delivering mail up to engine parts, pieces that could weigh in excess of 500 to 700 pounds.
And I have to imagine, back to the mail, I mean, even though, yes, email is there and Skype and FaceTime and the like, it has to be a morale booster for these sailors to actually get, envelopes from home.
Oh, there's no question. There's still nothing like getting a handwritten letter, from your loved one. It really boosts their spirits quite a bit. And not only letters, but just like how we in our homes order through a catalog, whether it be through eBay or Amazon or whatnot, they have the ability to do that right from sea. So they'll order something through Amazon, have it dropped off at us. We, in return, deliver to the vessels.
And knowing that navigation season runs from April 1st to Christmas Eve, something tells me that you and your team get to be Santa's helper somewhere toward the end of the season.
Yeah, it definitely gets to be that way. You get up around the holiday season, around November or so, then all of a sudden it jumps up. Yeah, you can tell there's a lot of Christmas items being dropped off.
Bill Redding is a boat captain and dispatcher with the J.W. Westcott, the Detroit River-based boat that's the world's first floating zip code. Bill, good to talk with you. Thanks so much.
Oh, my pleasure indeed.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. What will it take to pull Michigan schools out of the mire of middling to poor student achievement. Michigan students now score among the bottom tier of states nationally on the National Assessment of Educational Progress exams. That's just one measure. States that once trailed Michigan's educational performance are now leaving our kids in their dust. What's working elsewhere that could improve Michigan schools? That's the question Bridge Magazine tackled in a series of reports entitled The Smartest Kids in the Nation, done by Bridge writers Ron French and Chastity Pratt-Dossi. Ron and Chastity, so good to have you back with us.
Thanks for having us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Chastity, you explored four states, Massachusetts, Minnesota, Florida, and Tennessee. Why did you and Ron pick those four?
Well, we picked states with schools that were achieving at levels that, you know, were either at a fast rate of progress or they were at the top of the game. And we also wanted to make sure that we went to states where there were Democrats and then some states that were Republican. We didn't want to just go to the Democratic states or just go to the Republican states. So that would open up people's eyes here in Michigan and you know, just keep the conversation clean of, you know,
partisanship,
any partisanship or any, you know, people accusing us of being biased.
And you find that in these states, generally, the states that are successful, education is a nonpartisan issue as opposed to the way we see it in Michigan.
Definitely.
And two of these states were really rocking it anyway, right? And then two of them have come from way behind Michigan to really lap us.
Well, Massachusetts, it's kind of that state that's become the darling of school reform in the nation. Everybody talks about Massachusetts because a generation ago, they were in the middle of the pack, right, with Michigan, neck and neck on some national standards. And now they're way clearly ahead of everyone. And what they did was they really said, look, you know, they took that look in the mirror, right, Ron? And they said, this is not good enough.
And what you find in Minnesota is the same sort of thing where it's Minnesota. It's a Midwestern state.
Great Lake state like us?
Sure. You know, if you just think about it, you know, as a layman, you would think, what the heck would they have going for them that Michigan does not? But they lead the nation in math. They are top 10 in every category you can imagine. So they've done something right. And so we have that in Massachusetts to look at to see, you know, these very high achieving states, very different, but they're doing something right.
And Florida and Tennessee?
Florida and Tennessee both had scores lower than Michigan 10 years ago. Their scores are still sort of in the middle of the pack. But what you've seen over the past decade is just a fast rise in academic achievement as opposed to Michigan, where in a lot of the categories we have just tread water or even lost ground in some instances. So those are good examples of states that were struggling, just like Michigan, but they found some way to fix it.
Well, I want to break this down into areas that have triggered a lot of debate here in Michigan, sometimes controversy and bitter disagreement, and see what we can learn. Let's start with spending, with that lifeblood of money. How do the four states compare with Michigan in terms of just how much money they spend on K through 12 education, Chastity?
Well, there's a very, you know, amounts. You know, some spend more, some spend less. It's not so much how much they spend, it's how they spend it. You have them putting their money where their priorities are. You have them investing more in low-income students and students who are on the bad end of the achievement gap. And in Massachusetts, for instance, they, in 1993, with their whole Reform Act, they said, okay, look, we're going to make our standards tougher and we're going to fund the children who need the most attention. They came up with 19 different factors for how they would fund different schools. And they really said, okay, students who have special needs, students who are low income and come to school with more needs, we're going to give them more. So they weighted their student funding. So the kids who need more get more.
And around here, Tennessee and Florida actually spend less than Michigan, and they're getting these incredible rates of improvement.
Notably less than Michigan. Minnesota spends about the same and get a lot better student achievement. Florida and Tennessee spend pretty remarkably less. Their teachers are paid a lot less. But the way we look at it is when you see that those states are spending less and Massachusetts is spending more, what we look at is that it, probably spending is not the key. As Chastity said, it's really how you spend it. What you found, for example, in Florida is that they routed some money in different directions, that they decided the third grade reading was going to be a big priority for them, and they just stuck a boatload of money It wasn't new money. They just changed where the money was going. They took a boatload of money and put it into both intervention and for teacher training in the early grades.
How about teacher salaries in these states?
Oh, well, Massachusetts spends a lot. I think they're like at the top of the pile. They're spending on their teachers. And again, it's the same thing. You're going to see a varied response or just, you know, results as far as, you know, teacher salary. Some spend more, some spend less. But in Massachusetts, they said, okay, look, we want teachers to be better at teaching. And so I don't think the salaries are as important as the training that they're investing in these states.
That's exactly where I wanted to go next. I wanted to find out what you found in these four states about teacher training and professional development, and also how smoothly all that came about, because I'm wondering if there was resistance when reforms needed to be made.
As far as training goes, that's one of the things that was consistent between these states. All of them put a lot of emphasis on actually giving training to their teachers once they get into the classroom, as opposed to just handing them the keys and saying, good luck for the next 40 years. What you find in Tennessee over the past several years have provided state-sponsored, state-funded training for 70,000 of their teachers. And those teachers then go back into their own schools and become the teacher leaders for those schools. The number that have in Michigan that have received state-sponsored, state-funded Common Core training, zero.
And that's a major difference. Investing in teachers and supporting teachers is probably one of the biggest differences between Michigan and these other states. They're investing in training them in the Common Core, which is the direction that all these states and Michigan, you know, have agreed. We're going to go with the Common Core standards. And these states have said, well, okay, we're going to train our teachers in the Common Core standards. And there's going to be, you know, consistent across the state. We've not done that here in Michigan. So it's like giving the teachers this mandate and telling the schools individually will figure out how to get it done.
And that's what we've done in Michigan.
Definitely.
We're talking with Bridge Magazine writers Ron French and Chastity Pratt Dawsey. Their series of reports called The Smartest Kids in the Nation explore K through 12 education in Massachusetts, Minnesota, Florida, and Tennessee. Four states with high-performing or fast-improving schools. Students in these four states are making great strides in their schooling, while Michigan students are still mired in middling to poor test scores. So what can we learn from them? Let's talk about getting an early start. Now, Governor Snyder's made early childhood education a big priority with the Great Readiness Program. I'm wondering how this effort in Michigan compares and contrasts with what's happening, especially in Minnesota and Florida.
Right. That's a very good point. Here in Michigan, we have made a big investment over the last couple of years in our preschool program, which is for our low and moderate income families to get their kids into preschool programs at age of four. That's fantastic.
Commendable. Very commendable.
Very commendable. What you see in Minnesota is a program that takes that exponentially farther. They have a preschool program, but they also have a program that is unique in the nation, which they say is maybe a key factor for why Minnesota's scores are so good all the way through school. They have a program for 0 to 4. Okay. Now, this doesn't mean that a newborn is sitting in a classroom for 8 hours a day.
Right.
But it does mean that families, anytime they want between birth and the time they enter kindergarten, can sign up for classes. And what it is 90 minutes a week. And you go in with your kid, and the parent has to be there. Now, what makes this program unique is the parent part of this, because what they do is this is all by certified teachers that are, you know, specializing in this area.
This is not a play group.
This is not a play group, no. But they teach the parents how to become their child's first teacher. They teach them how to play and how to do things that is intellectually correct for the age of their child. And what that does is helps the parents learn how to prepare the kids so that when they go to preschool and kindergarten, they're ready. It's not all that costly, but no one else does it, and it's something I think a lot of states should look at.
Money-wise, you say it's not that costly.
Not really.
Yeah.
Not. You know, it's a few hundred dollars per kid because it's only 90 minutes long. But it's something that, you know, it takes a lot of infrastructure, but it's something they've done for 40 years in Minnesota.
Talking about testing, you put lots of effort into your series looking at testing in these four states. And one striking example showed that it's not all kumbaya and sweetness and light as these reforms were made, and that's the Massachusetts Comprehensive Assessment System exam. What happened when it was first given in 1998?
Well, it wasn't a pretty picture, quite honestly. Students, they didn't do well. They gave it to 4th, 8th, and 10th graders, and they said that this test is going to be a test that you're going to have to pass in a 10th grade to graduate. In that first year, I think something like 27% of kids passed. And yeah, imagine
wow.
imagine if 27% of our kids passed the MME in Michigan, it would be an enormous backlash. I'm just assuming,
yes. But there was in Massachusetts.
Yeah, people said, oh wait, this is something's wrong with the test. The NAACP said the kids of color are going to be left behind. They're not going to graduate. We can't. This is no. Stop. Wait.
I can totally imagine this all being said and then some in Michigan.
There was total backlash.
Yeah.
But the surprising and interesting thing was that Massachusetts said, okay, they're not doing well. We're going to give them a few years to figure out this in the classroom with the teachers before we really make it required for graduation. And they stuck with the test. And today, most kids are passing it on their first time. They get to take it over and over. Mm-hmm. But most kids are passing it on their first time in Massachusetts. They stuck with it.
And then taking that out, you look at the fact that Massachusetts scores the way the brightest countries elsewhere.
This is a difficult test that they're giving in Massachusetts starting in the 90s. And it's so difficult that it's helping to prepare kids there to take these international tests. And in our series in Bridge Magazine, we point out that if Massachusetts were a country, they'd be scoring second in eighth grade science on the Thames. So they're doing something right. It's a really tough test. They stuck with it, and it's paying dividends.
And it sounds like it's kind of a theme that runs through your entire series, The Smarter Kids in the Nation. Teachers and the kids rise to whatever tough standard is set with the right support.
With the right support.
Right. Set your expectations high and make those expectations clear. What I heard among a lot of teachers I spoke to was that whether you like the standards or not, it's very clear what we're supposed to do, what every kid is supposed to learn by the end of third grade, by the end of fourth grade. And that allows teachers to focus on the actual teaching in the classroom, as opposed to every year wondering, oh my goodness, how is the test changing this year? What's going to happen? If you set standards, keep them there, and make them clear that so that everyone understands, it really can go a long way.
And support. You have to support the teachers.
Exactly.
You have to train the teachers. You have to help them to help the kids. Teachers appreciate that, and they stick with you and work with you through the process.
How about charter schools? How much of a presence do charter schools have in these four states you studied?
All the states have them. All the states at different degrees again, but they all have the charter schools, but they are not governed in a way that we govern ours here in Michigan. And they have different achievement levels. Massachusetts, again, having really successful.
Is there more accountability?
Schools. There's extremely high standards and way more accountability.
And mechanisms to get rid of schools that don't perform
very
well.
Very definitely.
And
their idea is that charter schools are created to be high-achieving schools, and if they're not, they'll close them down. That's not our vision for charter schools in Michigan. We look at them, the law sets them up as a choice. There's no expectation or standard that they are supposed to be high-achieving.
What we found also is it's a lot like the amount of money you spend overall in K-12. It's a lot like your teacher's salaries. Charters are a big issue here in Michigan that we argue over all the time. But when you look at these high-achieving states, that doesn't seem to be the factor. It's not like the states with the most charters or the least charters are the highest. It's the accountability for those charters that seem to make a difference.
And I want to wrap up by talking about reform, because looking at all four states that you profiled, so as we look at Minnesota and Florida and Massachusetts and Tennessee, it took a lot of reform and a lot of change to get to the success they're having. Who triggered the push? Is there a theme that you saw amongst the four?
Yeah, it was always, in each of these cases, entities outside of the educational sphere. You had business leaders coming and saying, look, you're not going to get very far in your economy with this sort of academic achievement in your state. And they team up with, you know, politicians and, you know, researchers and educators and youth. Everyone, you know, eventually gets on board with the reform movement in these states.
And are we seeing that in Michigan? I mean, we've heard voices of discontent from the business community about we aren't getting what we need. But is it a strong enough voice to push reform through?
I think we have a start here, Cynthia. Mm-hmm. If you look at how business leaders got together and really pushed and were the driving force behind increased funding for our preschool program, looking at and saying, you know, we need over the long term for our talent to be better. And the way we do that is through better K-12 education. And the way that's going to happen is get to these kids early. If we could then marshal those same forces for a larger reform than just preschool, I think we could make some progress here.
Sometimes perspective is a very good thing. I'm wondering what you heard from officials in the other states as they look at Michigan and what they have to say about our approach to K-12 education.
They're saying, look, you know, it has to be a joint effort. And this bickering, the Republicans want this, the Democrats want that, it's going to get you nowhere. How do you end it, Ron? You got to go big or go home?
Go big or go home. That's what someone said in Tennessee. This is something a former governor of Tennessee said. This is something that has to be stuck with through three governors, four governors, five governors. You can't be changing every time a political party changes. There has to be nonpartisan enough that everyone sees the importance of this and they stick with it. It's clarity and willing to stick with some tough reforms.
It has to be that sacred issue that nobody messes with for their own political purposes.
And it makes you just wonder, could we ever see that day in Michigan where all the niff-gnawing and the finger-pointing and the partisan divides could ease up in order to pursue this common goal?
The bigger question is, can we afford not to? Where we are in our unemployment, where we are in our economy, we're at the bottom in those measures as well. Can we afford to ignore this? Can we afford to not do anything? It seems like we can only afford to do something big now.
Absolutely. What you find a lot in these states is that there is a moment of clarity, that they looked in the mirror. Another state said it was like a deer in the headlights. There was a moment where they said, oh my gosh, we have to fix this now. It's almost like having a minor heart attack and saying, I have to change my way of life. This is what has to happen. And the question is whether Michigan realizes they've had that deer in the headlights moment.
Chastity Pratt-Dossi and Ron French with Bridge Magazine and their series, The Smartest Kids in the Nation, can be found at bridgemi.com. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's the big bad secret no one really wants to talk about. Early Detroiters owned slaves.
It's always a surprise because even well-informed, well-educated people never happen to learn that slavery existed in Detroit.
The history of slave owning in Detroit, next time on Stateside. Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Michelle Hahn, Haley Hirschman, and Annie Norris. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.